Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with experts in breast, lung, genitourinary, and hematologic malignancies to discuss key trends and anticipated advances for 2021 in oncology. Howard A. Skip Burris III, MD, FASCO, FACP, Chief Medical Officer and President of Clinical Operations at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, and a 2014 Giant of Cancer Care and Drug Development, and Debu Tripathi, MD, Professor of Medicine and Chair of the Department of Breast Medical Oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, were among those who forecast that the development of additional targeted and immune therapies are expected to permeate the oncology landscape across a broad range of malignancies in 2021. Echoing such views were Balazs Halmos, MD, MS, Director of the Multidisciplinary Thoracic Oncology Program and Director of the Section of Thoracic Medical Oncology for Montefiore Health Systems, First Director of Clinical Cancer Genetics and Professor of Clinical Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Niraj Agarwal, MD, a professor of medicine and director of the genitourinary oncology program at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and Lori A. Leslie, MD, a hematology and oncology specialist at John Thurer Cancer Center. In our exclusive interviews, each expert discussed their expectations for research and drug development in oncology in the new year.
So across all of oncology, I think several different buckets. So one that was highlighted at some meetings earlier in the year are the continued success of small molecules, oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors against certain mutations. So we have seen that with the pemigatinib, FGFR2 inhibitor, and cholangiocarcinoma. That'll certainly play in some other areas. KRAS, the long undruggable target. We've seen the KRAS G12C inhibitors. We've had the approval of the RET inhibitors in lung cancer and in thyroid cancer. So we're seeing that we no longer have undruggable targets, and we know that when we can find driver mutations in small sets of patients, it's certainly a place to go and pursue development. I think the other story is what's next beyond checkpoint inhibitors. We have done lots of trials with Sarah Cannon and all the different acronyms of the molecules that are being given in combination with PD-PD-L1 inhibitors. And now we're starting to see some results emerge. We're seeing that combinations with other antibodies known as TIGIT or LAG-3 are actually showing activity, improved activity over what seemed to be a checkpoint inhibitor alone, as well as activity in patients who previously had a checkpoint inhibitor. And that's playing out in tumors as diverse as lung cancer, colon cancer, melanoma. So really across the spectrum. So I think there's a lot of excitement there. And then lastly, starting to see the immune effector cell, the CAR therapies, those sorts of approaches to immune therapy coming into solid tumors. We've got more than a dozen trials ongoing at Sarah Cannon. Patients are being matched to those studies. There's a great deal of enthusiasm. And I'm optimistic that we're going to see this class of immune effector cells begin to help more patients than just those that have hematologic malignancies. I will throw in a plug for personalized cancer vaccines here. So timely, as we're speaking, we're talking about the COVID-19 vaccines coming out. That platform by some of the leading biotech companies working on the vaccines were platforms that were being utilized to develop personalized cancer vaccines. Interestingly, I've heard from several of the scientists that actually the COVID vaccine was pretty simple compared to what they're working on for cancer vaccines. But I think we're going to see the play of cancer vaccines coming in. I think we're going to see that become part, and we're going to need to have randomized trials to see the impact. So there are already some personalized cancer vaccine trials ongoing, for example, in melanoma, plus or minus the immunotherapies. And I think we'll see that in several other disease settings. So I think that's really, really key. We're also going to see some randomized trials that are coming out in lung cancer and in melanoma with the use of adding compounds to checkpoint inhibitors. So we're going to see results about TIGIT and LAG coming forward. And then we're seeing very quickly in breast cancer some of these new approvals in late line settings. So the refractory patients that have benefited from trastuzumab deruxtecan and from sacituzumab, those trials are now moving into the frontline setting in HER2 patients, even including HER2 lows, and then of course with sacituzumab in triple negative. So we're doing what we need to do, which is having these drugs approved in late line settings, seeing them overcome relapse refractory settings, and having them move quickly into the frontline arena. So a lot of promise across most of the disease entities from the research that's been done.
You're going to hear about important updates at every meeting. We, of course, a year and a half ago had the first approval of atezolizumab in triple negative breast cancer in combination with nab-paclitaxel. We then saw a follow-up study with paclitaxel not show an improvement. And then even more recently, the approval of pembrolizumab from the KEYNOTE-355 study, which tested either nab-paclitaxel or gemcitabine and carboplatin with and without pembrolizumab. And that did show an improvement in progression-free survival, and which led to its recent approval as well. Dr. Mittendorf is going to be presenting an update also on a neoadjuvant trial of the IMPASSION 131, which is looking at atezolizumab in the neoadjuvant setting. And there are actual trials now going on in hormone receptor positive breast cancer in the neoadjuvant setting with pembrolizumab in patients with grade 3 hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer. So we're going to be getting a lot of output from trials, and the ones that are in early stage, I think, are very important, preventing a recurrence in the first place if it can be given with good quality of life. In fact, Dr. Mittendorf is going to be presenting the quality of life data from the IMPASSION 131 study, showing that using health-related quality of life indices that these patients actually do not have a perceivable worsening of their symptoms. So this is obviously important, especially in the adjuvant setting. Combinations of immunotherapy with other drugs to make breast cancer more immunogenic and very novel areas. And then the other area I'll point out briefly is antibody drug conjugates. This is a very exciting area. We now have seen the approval of a new HER2 antibody drug conjugate, trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is now approved in refractory disease and is being tested in a randomized setting. And then also the recent approval of sacituzumab govitecan, which is an antibody drug conjugate that targets the TROP2, a common cell surface antigen with SN38, irinotecan metabolite. So showing unprecedented response rates and improvements in survival that we have not seen with triple negative breast cancer, even with immunotherapy. So we're going to be getting some updates from the ASCENT trial, which is a randomized trial leading to the approval of sacituzumab govitecan, looking at different biomarkers. So the field is moving quickly, and those are just a few of the highlights. In the interest of time, I can't really go over all of them, but I think that 2021 is going to be a refreshing year in many ways, with a lot of new data and advances for our patients with breast cancer.
2020, despite being a terrible year as a result of COVID, actually has been a good year for thoracic oncology. And kudos to all the companies, completing their studies. Kudos to all the clinical investigators putting patients on studies. Kudos to patients to participating. But certainly the FDA has done a fantastic job, I have to say, in the middle of this pandemic, taking their job very seriously and looking at data quickly so that patients can receive medications that are more effective, but also safer in the middle of this pandemic. Oral drugs, with great safety profiles, not necessitating visits, to the physicians that often. Also changing, the schedules of some of the immunotherapies that we're offering to our patients to more convenient schedules. So I think the FDA has done a great job this year. And as to next year, I think it will be hard to replicate what we've seen this year in terms of the great successes, but there's definitely a number of stories that will continue to unfold. One that is the highlight now, but certainly is very early stage, is the KRAS story. We'll learn a lot more in the coming year or two as to what is the activity of the different set of compounds. How can they be combined with conventional treatments upfront? Chemotherapy, immunotherapy, second line treatment, and is there some benefit of one compound versus the other, or particular molecular combinations, for example, the KRAS G12C plus, you know, some of the downstream inhibitors, you know, for example, the SAS inhibiting compound. So great excitement in that field, and that's a significant subset of patients, so it will be very important to watch. Another aspect is looking at, you know, the smaller but still very important molecular subsets. We've seen a lot of exciting data about EGFR exon 20 insertion, you know, positive patients. Those data sets will continue to mature, and the FDA might make some calls on some of the leading molecules. So we do anticipate some great excitement there. ERBB2 is emerging as a real target now in lung cancer with these excellent antibody-drug conjugates that have shown success in breast and colon and gastric cancer, and likely will yield great benefits in our ERBB2-positive lung cancer patients as well. Of course, ERBB2 is a complex target in lung cancer. We have ERBB2 mutations, different types, ERBB2 amplification as well. So there's a lot that we need to learn as to which particular patient subsets could be the best candidates for these novel approaches. Of course, immunotherapy will continue to find new ways to benefit our patients. The TIGIT molecules, you know, brought a lot of excitement, but there's definitely a lot of other approaches as well that we're so keen to support, and that could include different vaccines, you know, that are being developed, that can include expanding different lymphocyte subsets now that we can do, and could also, you know, be more individualized approaches, almost like the CAR T cell type approaches that are being investigated in some of these particular subsets. So a lot of excitement there. And let's not forget that ultimately we want to cure more patients. So bringing all this to an earlier stage setting where we have the highest chance for cure will be so important. Some of the adjuvant studies, you know, with the immunotherapy compounds will start reading out, and that will be incredibly important to watch out for and quickly integrate if positive results are obtained, and we all are keeping our fingers crossed for that. And, of course, incorporating these novel compounds, especially the immunotherapy combinations, into the stage 3 setting, where with Pacific we've seen a major advance, but why not take another step forward? So, you know, we do want to support those studies as well, and we'll be very eager to see the readout of those. Definitely the adjuvant studies, some of them there might be a readout. Some of them, you know, completed accrual maybe about a year ago, if I'm correct. And you know, they will take some time to mature, but maybe some inkling, you know, will come out, especially if the results are very positive. You know, we'll get an earlier read, you know, than if, you know, the results seem to be fairly similar between the, you know, experimental and control group. So that might be one. Another one that I'm very eager to see is a compound called canakinumab. This is kind of an anti-inflammatory agent that actually came from left field, from the cardiovascular literature, where they found that as much as it did benefit patients post-MI to some extent, but also did reduce lung cancer incidence by almost 50% in those studies. Stunning results in a way. And there's a number of clinical studies, phase 3s, that are being completed and likely to read out very soon. I'm very eager to see that, because that would be a completely new class of compounds that could impact our practices. I'm very curious about that. Well, it's hard not to think about molecular testing with the ease that we have now with ctDNA as something that you have to, you know, continue to bring up. You know, each practitioner needs to start being familiar with the platforms, you know, that can be used, you know, so conveniently, so easily, and so powerfully to impact patient care. And now we have very validated settings in lung cancer. We're very ahead of all other fields. Now we know that upfront, if you have limited amount of tissue, maybe not enough, you know, to complete testing, or there's a need to speed up testing, you know, due to a sick patient, very symptomatic patient, et cetera, ctDNA can make a huge impact. If you identify one of these actionable alterations by ctDNA, you can act upon it just like as if it was detected in tissue. And it also is very important in the acquired resistance setting to monitor secondary changes and then impacting second line and subsequent lines of therapy. So both of those settings, very validated use. I'm very eager to see now ctDNA moving into kind of the MRD platforms, where we can maybe detect minimal residual disease after surgery or definitive chemoradiation. Maybe we can use it to monitor immunotherapy responses. We've seen a lot of exciting data just this year reflecting that. So I think that's the next wave, the MRD detection with the ctDNA platforms that are being developed, for example, by Natera. And then also great excitement about sort of early detection as well with some of these novel technologies.
So I'd like to start with prostate cancer first. there is no doubt that approval of PARP inhibitors was the biggest highlight in the treatment of patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So how it is going to shape 2021? I think we are going to see movement of PARP inhibitors to earlier lines of therapies. There are three trials going on in first-line metastatic CRPC setting, which will be declaring results, I think, in 2021. A new trial in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer has been started with niraparib, known as Amplitude trial. The trial is accruing patients all over the planet. And I think that is going to be telling us the results of this trial in next 2 years or 3 years, whether PARP inhibitors will move to first-line therapy setting in patients castration-sensitive prostate cancer. The story is going to be dominated by PARP inhibitors mainly in next 6 months or 7 months. However, the AKT inhibitors are another evolving story, mostly with ipatasertib. We'll see how overall survival matures over time. And then another drug, capivasertib, which is already being investigated in patients with metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer. The trial has already started. And of course, we should not forget about the cutting-edge immunotherapy drugs, which are going to be dominating the research field in metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer patients. I would start with bispecific antibody, the AMG-160, which showed very promising responses in heavily treated patient population. So I think we are looking forward to results from this bispecific antibody targeting cytotoxic T cells and targeting PSMA. Another very promising combination, or I would rather say two combinations, are cabozantinib with atezolizumab. A phase 3 trial has already started, known as CONTACT 2 trial. Another combination is pembrolizumab with olaparib, another phase 3 trial. I think I feel quite excited about these two trials. I would like to highlight AR degraders, so androgen receptor degraders, a completely novel class of drug. Again, we saw promising data in first-in-human trial, and we are hoping to see even more conclusive, positive results in our patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. In 2020, undoubtedly, the biggest story in the treatment of metastatic urothelial carcinoma or the bladder cancer was the success of Javelin Bladder 100 trial with avelumab or frontline maintenance avelumab therapy. I don't think we have seen a similar magnitude of survival benefit with any treatment ever in the setting of metastatic bladder cancer. So that is the major highlight. But we also heard that treatment with enfortumab in third line metastatic bladder cancer setting. So enfortumab, as you know, is a part of the new wave of therapy known as antibody drug conjugate coming for patients with bladder cancer. So enfortumab antibody drug conjugate, which basically targets Nectin-4 receptor on bladder cancer and delivers a chemotherapy payload of MMAE, was associated with significant improvement in overall survival compared to the control arm. And we will see more mature final data in GU-ASCO in 2021. Another antibody drug conjugate is sacituzumab, which is targeting TROP2 and delivering a chemotherapy payload of SN38, which is the final active version of irinotecan chemotherapy. So both sacituzumab and enfortumab are going to be shaping field of metastatic bladder cancer, in my view, in 2021 and beyond. We will see various combination of these drugs coming up. They will be tested in first-line setting. The phase 3 trial of enfortumab has already started in the first-line setting, where enfortumab is being combined with pembrolizumab, the immune checkpoint inhibitors. I think similar trials of sacituzumab are expected down the line. So basically, this will mean that these highly well-tolerated chemotherapy will be available to our patients who are newly diagnosed with metastatic bladder cancer in the very near future. I'm really hoping in next 2 years at the most. In the field of metastatic renal cell carcinoma, no doubt the biggest highlight of the year was the positive 9ER trial, which tested the combination of cabozantinib with nivolumab versus sunitinib in more than 600 patients with newly diagnosed metastatic renal cell carcinoma. Another combination is lenvatinib with pembrolizumab. And this trial, the CLEAR trial, was reported positive in a press release in early November 2020. And we expect to see the full data from this trial in the very near future in 2021. So these are the two combinations, cabozantinib with nivolumab, which I think will get FDA approval, should get FDA approval in early 2021, and then followed by lenvatinib with pembrolizumab. I think the challenge will be how to sequence these regimens for our patients. Another huge story in patients with metastatic renal cell carcinoma is the emergence of a completely novel class of drug known as HIF-2 alpha inhibitor, MK-6482. This drug, HIF-2 alpha inhibitor, has already been tested in earlier trials and showed very encouraging results in patients who have been treated with multiple lines of therapies. I think the most important attribute of this drug is the highly well-tolerated nature of this drug. This drug has minimal side effects. Anemia and fatigue are the most dominant side effects. Otherwise, based on what we have heard so far, this drug is an ideal drug for patients who have already progressed in multiple lines of therapies and are frail and really looking for a good quality of life while improving survival. Not surprisingly, the HIF-2 alpha inhibitor is already moving to second line and first line therapies in various combinations with cabozantinib, combination with lenvatinib, combination with immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I think we will be seeing the field of metastatic renal cell carcinoma rapidly evolving in 2021 with approval of cabozantinib with nivolumab, approval of pembrolizumab plus lenvatinib, newer trials testing HIF-2 alpha inhibitor in various combinations, and hopefully approval of HIF-2 alpha inhibitor for our patients.
In hematologic malignancies, cellular therapy and targeted therapies continue to be the hot topic. So specifically looking at indolent lymphomas, I'm most excited about CAR T-cell therapy, as well as bispecific antibody therapies. So I think we've seen a lot about that at ASH 2020. One of the studies, ZUMA-5, looking at CD19 CAR T-cell therapy in patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma, the primary analysis was presented, showing high overall response rates, 92 in the cohort, 92% and 76% complete response for all evaluable patients with follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma. And of the 84 patients with follicular lymphoma, overall response rate was 95% with a CR of 80%. And responses seem durable, toxicity seems manageable. So I'm hopeful this will transform, how we treat relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, at least in the near future. There were several other abstracts presented looking at bispecific antibody therapy targeting CD20 and CD3, for example. There's a few different constructs, all with slightly different biology, and mostly phase one results being reported, though seems to be very effective, particularly in indolent lymphomas. Common side effects being things like CRS that are relatively easy to manage. So I think in 2021, we should certainly keep our eyes open for more bispecific and in certain heme malignancy trispecific antibodies that are being developed moving forward. Another big development that we're hearing more and more about is how we take agents that have modest kind of single agent activity, at least in indolent lymphomas, and non-overlapping toxicity profiles, and how to combine these when synergy has been shown in the preclinical setting. So one example of this in follicular lymphoma specifically is a study that was presented by Dr. Ujjani, and that I participated in looking at the combination of ibrutinib and venetoclax in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. So ibrutinib by itself has a response rate around 20% with 11% CRs, and venetoclax has a single agent response rate in follicular lymphoma around 38%. But when combining the two, at least at the phase two recommended dose that's been established, those overall response rates were as high as 83%, with about a third of patients achieving a complete remission. So it just shows that we've got, a number of single agents with modest, if best, activity that are easy to tolerate. And as we learn how to rationally combine them moving forward, particularly in relapsed refractory indolent lymphoma, I'm hopeful that we'll be shifting towards, a personalized, molecularly driven combination non-chemo approach for more patients with relapsed refractory indolent lymphomas. Speaking a little more about CLL specifically, I think the trend there is also combination targeted therapy and doing a risk and MRD, minimal residual disease adapted approach for all patients. So we did hear updates from Captivate and Clarity that are looking at combination of BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor with a risk adapted, at least in Captivate, a risk adapted MRD based consolidative approach. So though the data presented so far at ASH 2020 isn't necessarily practice changing at this moment, looking forward to 2021 and beyond, I'm very hopeful that we will gain more data about how to individualized treatment for CLL using targeted therapies in a way that we're able to offer time-limited rather than indefinite therapy, hopefully for all or at least the vast majority of patients with CLL. So I don't think we had any major practice-changing results about risk-adapted therapy based on minimal residual disease, at least in indolent lymphomas and CLL. There may be some in myeloma. I'm just not as familiar with that data. One major thing that I think was highlighted, including a presentation that I was involved with, was the real-world study looking at patients with high-risk CLL. As an oral presentation, I was given the opportunity to present data from a real-world study that we did looking at patients with CLL treated with either ibrutinib or chemoimmunotherapy and stratified by risk status. So we know that patients with high-risk CLL, it's been shown repeatedly in clinical trials, that they do not do as well with chemoimmunotherapy or monoclonal antibody therapy, that really the standard of care in high-risk CLL is to treat patients with targeted therapy, whether that be BTK inhibitor or BCL2 inhibitor, just targeted therapy in general. So in the real world, actually Dr. Mato at ASH this year presented some information about the incidence of molecular testing and risk stratification in the community practice setting and found that testing rates are low. So even though it's in IWCLL guidelines and NCCN guidelines to check every patient for FISH for 17P or 11Q, which are high-risk features, TP53 mutation status, immunoglobulin heavy chain gene rearrangement status, which if it's unmutated, that's a high-risk factor. The rates of actually testing for these things in the community setting are low. I have the absolute most respect for general oncologists. I do not know how people keep up with everything across breast cancer, colon cancer, lymphomas, et cetera. I have the benefit of only treating lymphoma and CLL, so these guidelines are obviously well known to me, but I think translating them into the community setting where people are busy and need to keep up with everything has been challenging. So, rates of testing are low. For FISH, it was around, less than a third of patients. For P53 mutation testing, I think, testing rates are around 10%. So really it should be the standard for 100% of patients. So we looked at charts from 516 patients with CLL, including patients from 40 clinical sites in the United States. About two thirds or 68% were community practices and the third were academic practices. And we looked for patients, risk testing with FISH, mutated P53 status or unmutated IGHV. If patients had a known absence of all those things, they were considered non-high risk. If they had the presence of any or more than one, they were considered high risk. And so of those 516 charts, we identified 271 patients that had high-risk CLL, 175 were treated with ibrutinib and 96 with chemoimmunotherapy. And we found that outcomes were better for patients treated with ibrutinib compared to CIT with high-risk CLL, as we would expect from, the way the guidelines are written in prior clinical trials. So we used time to next treatment as a surrogate for progression-free survival. and found that the median time to next treatment was not reached in the ibrutinib arm during the study period, but was 34 months for CIT. Another way to look at longer-term outcomes was looking at the percentage of patients that only required one line of therapy during the study period, and that was significantly higher for those on ibrutinib. So during the study period, 74.7% of patients with high-risk DLL3 with ibrutinib only needed one line of therapy, compared to CIT, only 47% of patients needed one line of therapy, and the remainder went on to a second line of therapy. We did also look at intra-treatment differences in high-risk versus non-high-risk patients, and found that treating with targeted therapy in some way, at least partially, neutralizes the poor prognostic indication or implication of a P53 abnormality or unmutated IGVH. So we saw time to next treatment and percentage of patients requiring only one line of therapy was similar in the ibrutinib treated high risk versus non-high risk CLL. But in chemoimmunotherapy, that risk cannot be overcome. So those with high risk CLL treated with, you know, chemoimmunotherapy had a significantly shorter time to next treatment. And there was a much lower proportion of patients that only required one line compared to non-high risk CLL. We wanted certainly to look at patients with non-high-risk CLL, you know, CIT versus ibrutinib, because I think one major unanswered question is, in a patient without poor prognostic features, can they benefit from time-limited chemoimmunotherapy and get long PFS and maybe, you know, delay the time to which they need to start a indefinite targeted therapy such as ibrutinib? But we did equipose assessment to determine if the populations were similar enough to compare, and found that they were not similar enough to do an unbiased comparison. So unfortunately, we could not draw any conclusions about the non-high-risk patients from this study, but moving forward, you know, certainly are doing further studies to look into that. So in terms of practice-changing findings from this study, I certainly hope, and we hope, that it highlights the importance and need to check for high-risk features before initiating frontline or relapse refractory treatment for patients with CLL, because it has not only prognostic value in terms of telling, you know, the patient how you expect them to do with time, but it also has significant predictive value in that it can help with treatment selection. And patients with high-risk CLL really should not be treated with chemoimmunotherapy outside of extenuating circumstances.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.